madam, you see before you stand. Hey ho, never be still, the old original favourite grand. Grasshopper's greener berry and band, and the tune they play is an ask and buy. So the trip to even ho, up, down, to and fro, you have no word. Please leave us here, close our eyes to the octopus ride.
Isn't it good to be lost in the wood?
Sid Barrett wrapping up that short set of music as we are approaching the top of the hour with Octopus. Before the Sid Barrett, the Toadies went back to an album they put out called Heretics, where they re-envisioned a lot of their songs. So I played their big hit from the 90s, Possum Dixon. Possum Dixon, that's another band. Possum Kingdom, the name of the song I played for you. Hey, you know what? I do need to remind you of one thing and one thing only. That's each and every Thursday. You can join your rockin' attorney, Eric Jackson Lurie, for Quartz in Session. It's 2.5 hours of rock and roll, country, and soul with a focus on new music by your favorite classic artist. Again, it's Thursdays at 8, and it re-airs on Monday afternoon. Monday afternoon. You are listening to the Viva La Mock radio program, and my name is Paul, and I appreciate you listening. As always, you're thinking, hey, there's a song I want to hear on a future show. Well, you know what you have to do. There's only one thing you have to do. You have to email me. So if you email me, I might play it. Yeah, so the email address is wrctrequest@gmail.com. Indeed, that is the email address.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
I want to start today talking a little bit about so-called freedom. And the reason I say so-called is because much of the discussion of freedom, much of the use of the word freedom is actually coming from extreme authoritarians who only believe in the type of freedom that benefits them. They only believe in the type of freedom that allows them to impose whatever they want onto everybody else, restricting everybody else's freedom. It's an extremely authoritarian and historically popular with fascists perspective on what freedom means. The freedom to tell others what to do, for example, or the freedom to stay in power even when you lost an election. It's freedom to be extremely authoritarian, no matter what anybody else wants, says, or believes. And in the past, we've talked about the people that claim their rights. We saw this early with COVID a lot, actually. They focus on these are my rights. They claim their rights, but they're obsessed with their rights in a complete and total vacuum from the responsibilities that come with those rights and that allow everybody to maintain those rights. And this is sort of a similar thing, much the same way freedom during the pandemic that's been preached by a lot of these people means my version of freedom only, which is a very authoritarian concept and perspective. And, you know, some examples. By freedom, the state of Florida under Republican Governor Ron DeSantis is a really good example. There's a very good article in The Guardian that explains that the theme and the concept of freedom pushed by DeSantis and the Florida legislature is actually authoritarianism cloaked as freedom. Look at the so-called Stop Woke Act. And that imposes from above, from people who know nothing about education, what is allowed to be taught in individual classrooms. They talk about it as freedom, but it's actually extremely authoritarian. Republicans are talking about, in Florida, an extreme abortion ban without even an exception for rape or incest. That's an outrageously authoritarian way of telling women what they have to do. Outlawing mask requirements in all sorts of places. That's not freedom and liberty. It's authoritarian. You're imposing one option on all sorts of organizations, despite claiming to be about freedom. They claim to be against regulating business, and yet they say we are banning masking or vaccination requirements. And even in the context of the big lie around the 2020 election, they talk about the freedom to have only legal votes counted. That's what they say in all of these catchphrases. But ultimately, all of it is in service to the wildly dictatorial authoritarian idea that when you lose an election, you can find some way to stay in power. And there's few things more dictatorial than that. There's some really interesting research into the concept of competitive authoritarianism. You can Google that phrase and you'll find a ton of academic papers about it. And what competitive authoritarianism refers to is you have, in theory, the front of democratic institutions and electoral competition. Whoever convinces voters that they are the better candidate, the better choice, wins and gets to govern. But it's actually unfair competition where incumbents try to use all sorts of mechanisms, including courts. Remember Trump with his 63 court filings, the media going out at 2 a.m. and putting into the media the narrative that I actually won, manipulation of the voting systems, telling Georgia to do this and Arizona to do that. They're using the courts, media and the voting systems to stay in power even when they lose, when there is a front of fair democratic institutions. And that's a lot of what 2020 looked like. There's a very good Vox article which says what these people want to do is strike a balance where they want to rig and control elections just enough to stay in power, but make it all look democratic so that citizens believe they are choosing and they don't rise up. And it often doesn't quite work. I mean, it didn't quite work for them in 2020 in that ultimately Joe Biden was still inaugurated the president. But this concept of calling things the opposite of what they are, referring to a total ban on mask mandates as freedom, when in reality it's the opposite of freedom. It's really explored and fleshed out in detail in George Orwell's 1984. it's almost cliche. It's almost apocryphal. Tons of people love to misquote or misuse, or they misunderstand aspects of 1984, and they talk about 1984 when it really doesn't apply. But this opposite naming by authoritarians, it's straight out of the book. In 1984, you have the slogan, "War is peace, freedom is slavery." That's fundamentally, at a core level, what we're talking about here. And in fact, one of the scariest things is that if you look historically, fascism has a long history of being called freedom. Fascism uses explicitly populist, libertarian-sounding rhetoric. And they talk about, you know, a heroic mass effort to get back to some previous period where we had greatness. And we, you know, Trump literally using the greatness thing. It often demands loyalty to a single leader. It often leads to a cult of personality and unquestioned obedience to whatever the leader says. He says the election was stolen. It was stolen. And we will all repeat it uncritically, whether we truly believe it or not. Historically reminds us of many different things, and sort of like the calling card of those 4 years of Trump. And it continues because the rallies have restarted, which we'll talk about a little bit later. We have major news in terms of the more than 700 cases against alleged Trump rioters. There's more than 700 total cases now. And one of the things we've been wondering, waiting for, thinking about is, will there be more serious charges? A lot of the charges, even though collectively this was an attempted insurrectious coup to install the guy who lost in the White House, that was the general point of it, to really charge people with anything even remotely close to that requires pretty, you've got it close to have these people dead to rights and really be able to prove what they intended in participating in those riots. And that's really tough. We've talked about perjury. People perjure themselves all the time in court using the term perjury colloquially. But proving perjury is quite difficult. And you really don't see even a small fraction of instances of perjury actually prosecuted. A lot of the stuff we're talking about with January 6th, including sedition, is quite difficult to prove. And thus it makes it tough to say we're going to charge people with that. That has now changed, and things are changing very, very dramatically. The leader of the Oath Keepers and 10 other individuals have been indicted in federal court for seditious conspiracy and other offenses related to the U.S. Capitol breach. This is sort of a crossing of the Rubicon when it comes to the January 6th riots. And the Justice Department publication says that a federal grand jury in D.C. returned an indictment charging 11 defendants with seditious conspiracy. One of the main charges here is a guy named Elmer Stewart Rhodes III, a 56-year-old Texan who is the founder and leader of the Oath Keepers. That's a right-wing militia-type group. Rhodes was arrested in Texas. Another guy, Edward Vallejo, 63, also charged with seditious conspiracy. A bunch of other previously named defendants have been charged. Eight other individuals affiliated with the Oath Keepers have been charged in the investigation, and they remain as defendants in two related cases. These are really, really serious charges. The seditious conspiracy indictment alleges that following the 2020 election, Rhodes conspired with co-defendants to oppose by force the execution of the laws governing the transfer of presidential power by January 20th. They, via encrypted and private communications, coordinated and planned to travel to D.C. around January 6th to bring weapons to support their operation. They did travel, and they conspired through a variety of manners and means, including organizing into teams prepared to use force to transport firearms and ammunition. They recruited people. They organized trainings to teach and learn paramilitary combat tactics, on and on and on, with the point of preventing the lawful transfer of presidential power. These are really, really serious charges. And a sort of, I don't know that we would call this funny, but one of the things that the right has been saying, and Tucker has been saying this, and other Fox News hosts and others saying, if this was an insurrectious coup, if they were doing sedition, why haven't they been charged with that? In fact, just hours before the charges, Fox News dude Britt Hume, although to be honest, I don't even know if he's still at Fox News, but Britt Hume, who for a long time was at, he is still a political analyst on Fox News. He tweeted, here's a thought. Let's base our view on whether 1-6 was an insurrection, on whether those arrested are charged with insurrection. So far, none has been. Within hours, charges for seditious conspiracy to prevent a peaceful transfer of power. I had tweeted, so I guess they were waiting on the more serious charges. And a CNN legal analyst, Asha Rangappa, said, I don't think they were waiting. The more serious charges are also more complex and can take longer to gather evidence and put together. If you look at the indictment, it is incredibly detailed and you can't get that information overnight. So as Vox has now reported, these charges really change the whole feel of the riots. Vox writing, seditious conspiracy occurs when two or more people work together to plan to overthrow the government or the or prevent the execution of its laws. And that now on the basis of these charges, this has really stepped things up. Before we had seen disorderly conduct, obstructing an official proceeding before Congress. And even there, we've seen sentences close to 4 years. Seditious conspiracy carries a potential sentence of 20 years in prison. And importantly, these new charges refute the argument that the entire riots were overblown. That's been a story we hear from many right wingers. This is all overblown. It wasn't an attempted coup, wasn't an attempted insurrection, and nobody's been charged with anything like that. Well, now they have. And we may see, instead of 41-month sentences, we could see 10, 12, potentially up to 20, but probably not, year sentences. And that completely changes the entire story about what happened on January 6th. Could there be even more serious charges? Maybe. Maybe. We're going to wait and see. Let me know your thoughts. You can find me on Twitter at @dpacman and tell me what you think about this. Our program is an audience-funded program, and I would love for you to sign up at joinpacman.com. We do an extra show every day for our members. You can use the coupon code WOW22 to get a sizable discount and instant access to all of these great membership perks. All right, folks, the 2022 midterms have officially started, and I say that because Donald Trump's rallies are back. Not only does Donald Trump have a rally scheduled for January 29th in Texas, but this past Saturday, a few days ago, Donald Trump held his first rally of the year. It is already in support of 2022 candidates. We are in the 2022 midterms. This rally was in Florence, Arizona. It was an extremely dangerous rally. It was a rally incredibly corrosive to democracy based on the things that Donald Trump was saying. And the entire speech, quite frankly, sounded like a 2020 election speech, but it's 2022. And when you hear Donald Trump talk about information will soon come out of Arizona, you might be saying, about which election? He's not talking about the election in 2020, even though now it's 20. Yes, he is. He's still talking about the 2020 election. And at this point, if you believe any of this stuff, you are truly beyond reach. Now, the rally had all of the normal stuff, all of the normal Trump lies. Trump's left eye swollen, almost completely shut. I don't know that Trump's left eye opened during the entire rally. We still don't know what that's about. Blacks for Trump strategically placed on the stage right behind Trump. The crowd getting bored very quickly until he says the craziest of crazy things, at which point they show signs of life. And we're going to just look at a few different moments of this. And to me, the quintessential moment was Donald Trump, when finally addressing what happened on January 6, 2021, saying his main complaint is they only talk about the rioters. They don't talk about how big his crowd was on that day. Take a look at this.
that crowd. They talk about the people that walked down to the Capitol. They don't talk about the size of that crowd. I believe it was the largest crowd I've ever spoken before. And they were there to protest the election. You were there, right? Am I right? I think it was the largest crowd I've ever. And the fake news never talks about it. They never talk about it. Exactly how many of those?
It was the largest crowd at any insurrection incited by a sitting president ever. And the media won't tell you that. Beyond belief, guys. I mean, just utterly beyond belief. Maybe the most notable moment was when Donald Trump made these incredible claims that he clearly is getting from right-wing media like Tucker Carlson and other right-wing shows. Donald Trump said white people are being discriminated against for vaccination and for COVID treatment. If you're white, you are put at a disadvantage on getting treatment and on getting vaccines. That's what Trump said.
Just denigrating white people to determine who lives and who dies. If you're white, you don't get the vaccine, or if you're white, you don't get therapeutics. It's unbelievable to think this. And nobody wants this. Black people don't want it. White people don't want it. Nobody wants it. It's not even believable. You saw this a week ago where it came out. Nobody can even believe it. They don't even talk about it, and they don't want to talk about it because they know it doesn't work very well for them. But the Wall Street Journal described the practice race-based preferential COVID treatment. So that's what it is. You get it based on race. In fact, in New York State, if you're white, you have to go to the back of the line to get medical help. Think of it. If you're white, you go right to the back of the line. This race-based medicine is not.
So what's the story with this? Because people at the rally and on the online right just accepted it and ran with it. Number one, this is something that Tucker Carlson's been saying, and so have others. Now, here are the facts on this, because if people believe this, we're really in rough shape. White people, I feel like an idiot even talking about this. White people are not being excluded from vaccines. There's a plentiful supply, and there is no evidence white people are being sent to the back of the line for COVID care as a matter of public health policy. What Donald Trump and Tucker and others are referring to is a New York policy that allows race and ethnicity to be considered when dispensing oral antiviral treatments, which are of limited supply, because we know that race and ethnicity are a risk factor for COVID. OK, the idea of all of this policy is steer treatment to people with the most risk of severe disease from COVID. And as a result of that, we know that Hispanic folks and Black folks, as a result of historical health and social inequalities, are more at risk of being severely ill or dying from the virus. It's just a risk factor. That's all it is. And Tucker, I would say Trump is doing it. Trump doesn't know what he's doing. He's just repeating what he heard. People like Tucker and others are pretending there's not like a sort of multidimensional risk factor calculus that's done, and saying white people are being denied treatment and vaccines, which, of course, is not true. It's dangerous, a sort of fascist authoritarian type pablum. And it's also not true. Trump then seemingly admits he didn't win the election. This is just kind of another one of these funny moments. Take a look at this.
We did have tremendous success. You know, did you ever hear some of the little things where they analyze elections? If you win Ohio and Florida, you always win. We won Ohio and Florida. But if you win Ohio and Florida and Iowa, and we won big, all of them, then 100%. If you win a certain number of states having to do with legislatures and state, we won all of them, every one of them. There's like 15 of them, different little tests. And we won them all. The only thing we didn't win was the election, you know?
Yeah. So these little things are just dropped in where you say, oh, so you are saying you didn't win. And I'm sure if you called him on it, he would say, well, no, I mean that they took it from me. Trump also pushing another Tucker Carlson conspiracy, which is that it's essentially boiling down to the FBI did the riots. It wasn't really Trumpists. The FBI organized it and did it all. Here is Trump talking about that.
Exactly how many of those present at the Capitol complex on January 6th were FBI confidential informants, agents, or otherwise working directly or indirectly with an agency of the United States government? People want to hear this. How about the one guy? Go in. Get in there, everybody. Epps, get in there. Go. Nothing happens to him. What happened with him? Nothing happens. Did any of these individuals play any role whatsoever in proving or facilitating the events at the Capitol? That's what we want to know. And most importantly, why aren't they investigating November 3rd, a rigged and stolen election, without getting to the bottom of which we will never have a fair and free democracy? Why aren't they looking at that?
So again, Trump clearly watching right-wing media, picking up any old conspiracy that he hears. We've already debunked that one extensively. The other notable thing about this Trump rally is that Donald Trump was notably more transphobic than normal. Trump, I don't want to say he didn't do any transphobia during his presidency. He did. But Trump really almost relishing the transphobia here mentions post-birth abortion as well.
And we're done taking lectures on science from a party that tells us that men are women, women are men, and the babies, this is a fact, the babies can be killed even after birth, right? After birth.
So, of course, the post-birth abortion thing has also been debunked. At one point, Trump getting that look, you know how sometimes Trump looks visibly dazed, like that time when Trump said he wanted to talk about the oranges of the. Remember this?
Take a look at the oranges of the investigation.
Yeah. When Trump said that, he had this visibly confused look on his face. He had that same look when he, instead of talking about supply chain issues, he talked about supply change and looked very confused.
We never even heard the term supply change.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of a mixture of climate change and supply chain issues. Supply change, maybe that's what he meant. Okay, then Trump said, America is not great. Now, this is a notable moment because in criticizing Democrats and saying how bad things are under Democrats, they're not supposed to straight up say that we're not a good country. And Trump, you always say America is the best. America is the best always. But Trump actually now saying America is not great right now.
Because frankly, whether you like it or not, and some people would like, America is not great now.
Ooh.
We're a laughingstock all over the world.
Whoa.
And you know, I really think the borders are a horror show, but I really think that.
So that's a notable change in rhetoric. But overall, a really scary authoritarian fascist delusion of a rally. It's very clear that these are going to continue. There's one scheduled for 2 weeks to the day after this one on January 29th. The lies are going to continue. And one of the things that can't be ignored is that at this point, with Trump as the former guy rather than the current guy, the people that are going to these rallies are even more delusional than what we experienced when Trump was president. And I want to talk about that a little bit next. So in the last segment, we looked at the Trump rally itself. 2022 has officially started. Trump did a rally in Florence, Arizona. It was riddled with lies. It was riddled with sort of fascist authoritarian delusions. And it was crazy. And Trump's doing another rally on January 29th. The thing I want to get to now is that people were interviewed at the rally, and these are sick, dangerous people. But what's really interesting is that some of the crazy people at the Trump rally now are not even pro-Trump. We've talked about this split that has happened where you've always had the anti-Trump and the pro-Trump Republicans, but now you also have the pro-Trump and the formerly pro-Trump Republicans. And I'm going to play a couple of clips for you. Right Side Broadcasting actually doing something interesting, which is as crazy as they are. They were interviewing people that are like too crazy even for them, where the interviewer dude starts to kind of try to get away. Let's go to this first one. This is a sort of a former Trump person And you've got to really go line by line to understand the insanity. Take a look at this.
Hey, good. What's your name? Where are you from?
My name is Kyrie Billingsley, a.k.a. Flat Earth Boxer.
Okay, so first of all, this guy's a flat earther. His nickname is based on being a flat earther. So that's number one. Let's continue.
And it's my persuasion that it's clearly the apocalypse and that the vaccine is made of aborted children.
Now, the vaccine is not made of aborted children. That's a lie. And in keeping with all of the different, anti-COVID disinformation rules on all of our various platforms, I feel like I don't want to treat you in the audience like morons because I know you know that's not true. But I have to say the vaccines are not made from aborted children. That's a lie.
And a vaccine made of aborted children being fast tracked by one man named Donald J. Trump.
Now, that's interesting. He says that the vaccine was fast tracked by Donald Trump. That's not even true. A lot of these anti-vax people now are mad at Trump because Trump said the vaccine works to keep you alive. But they wrongly credit Trump with getting the vaccine done faster. That's something Trump wants you to believe. It's not even actually true.
Who the world's kind of, a lot of the Jewish world's expecting might be a very, very good thing for their interests.
Now, there it goes into anti-Semitic conspiracies. The idea that the deadly vaccine made from aborted children is something the Jews want to use to fill in the blanks. It doesn't really matter. But anti-Semitism is often lying there at the surface with a lot of these people.
But this vaccine is made of aborted children and it's for a virus that doesn't exist.
Now, COVID does exist. The gentleman says COVID doesn't exist. COVID does exist. We're just remaining in compliance here.
If they're pretending it does. And the problem with that is that if everyone's being compelled to edit their genetics with this vaccine.
Now, remember that the vaccine does not edit your genetics. That's a lie.
Aborted children. That's a lot like the days of Noah. And there have been signs in the heaven pursuant to all these things. And the vaccines came out exactly 1260 days following this sign.
I have to admit, I don't know the meaning of 1260 days or the religious part. It's less relevant to me.
Came law in Israel. So it's literally the mark of the beast. And a lot of people aren't talking about it.
Yeah,
hey, good.
It is true that a lot of people aren't talking about that because it's not worth talking about. But OK, so that's bonkers. Then they go and they interview another guy. And this guy says that Gavin Newsom is dead. Apparently, Gavin Newsom, the Democratic California governor, is a body double of some kind. And again, this stuff starts to get too crazy, even for the interviewer. Like the interviewer starts backing away and the interviewer is out of his mind.
Well, and Newsom's a clone, okay? They just took him out.
Yeah. So he says, this gentleman says Gavin Newsom is a clone. There's no evidence that Gavin Newsom was cloned.
He's a puppet for the left.
He's a different level. You're right.
Yeah,
but the real Governor Newsom has had his military tribunal and his Gitmo, and he's been executed. Yeah. Okay? Well,
there you go.
There you go, says the interviewer. And then lastly, and you guys tell me whether this is child abuse. Here is an interview with a 12-year-old at the rally. And what's going on at home that has led to this?
You're, 12. What is it about being a Republican that you're that made you decide to say, I'm an Republican? Like, what is it?
I'm an Republican.
Just my parents really talked to me and they didn't really force it on me. I could have picked. They wouldn't care.
Right. I somehow think that the mom wearing the Trump full regalia would care if this kid was a progressive. Tell me, convince me I'm wrong. I think she would care.
If who I picked, who I wanted my president.
Freedom and liberty and loving the country.
And the yes. Guns. He likes guns. The guns.
Yes.
12-year-old likes guns. Okay. So he likes guns and he's a Trumpist. What a beautiful day.
Your Second Amendment right.
Yes.
That's protected by the Constitution.
Yes.
That's right. You just can't rewrite it when you want to rewrite it.
Yes.
Like if you don't like guns, you don't get to say, well, I'm just going to erase the gun part and just write it my own.
Now, of course, there have been no modifications of the Second Amendment that have been made, by Democrats or whatever he's talking about.
You don't have that option.
Yep.
I got you.
And who
all
lives
right.
In the best country in the world?
And you live in the best country in the world. You got a good mom, too. Good parents. I like that. Thank you very much. 12 years old. We'll see in 6 years. I expect you to vote.
All right. So extremely disturbing stuff. I don't even know that I have more of a commentary other than to say we have a really horrifying situation in this country right now. If you've just been listening today, we'll have these clips in video form on our Instagram, which you can find at David Pakman Show. Today, I'm going to be speaking with Elizabeth Kopic, who's an assistant professor of linguistics at Boston University, who specializes in semantics, the study of meaning in human language. It's really great having you on. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I think this is a really important topic, and I'm very pleased to be giving my opinions about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess just to kind of set some context, oftentimes when people have discussions that are very politically oriented, like what does the Second Amendment really mean? Or what are the actual laws around deportation in terms of what should or can be decided versus what must be decided? Or, you know, we can think about all of these different political implications. There's often a split between the idea of a textualist interpretation that is just what's written versus one that considers when such a statute or law might have been written, or kind of all of these different factors that lend themselves more to interpretation. One aspect of this is, are we correctly understanding the textualist interpretation in terms of the way that it is written and what that even actually means? Can you talk a little bit about the basis for asking that question and maybe some examples of where the answer may be we're not understanding the language correctly necessarily?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's plenty of discussion about whether we should be textualists or purposivists or any other kind of ist, but there's much less discussion about whether lawyers and judges are actually competent to carry out textualism. There's this misconception that just because you subscribe to the word of the day, you speak English, and you did well in fifth grade grammar, you're qualified to make pronouncements about how the English language works, but there's a whole field of study called linguistics whose findings are applicable to these very, very consequential decisions. And thousands of innocent people can be summarily rounded up and put into federal prison, where slavery is legal, by the way, all because of linguistic ignorance. Example of that is in this case called Nielsen v. Priop. Priop is for Moni Priop. He was born in a refugee camp. He is therefore stateless. He can't be deported anywhere, but he's not a citizen of the United States. And he served a jail sentence for possession of marijuana, which ended 7 years before he was then rounded up by ICE and put into federal prison under this law that says that the government shall take into custody any alien, quote unquote alien, that's a non-citizen, who A, B, C, or D, where these are things that, some criminal offense they might have committed. When the alien is released, what does released mean? That means they were released from the custody that they were in before. And so it says that the government shall take into custody any alien who A through D, when the alien is released. Moni Priop was released 7 years before he was later taken into custody. And so the ACLU is defending him and saying he wasn't taken into custody when he was released. He was taken into custody 7 years later. So he should be released from federal prison now. And
so fundamentally, this is about the words shall and when. Is that really what this comes down to?
Well, there are a number of linguistic issues that arose. One is, what does when mean? Does it mean at the same time, or does it mean at the same time or as soon as possible thereafter?
Mm.
And the government, the Trump administration, was arguing for an interpretation that inserts or as soon as possible thereafter. So it's putting a little meat on the bones of the literal meaning. It's expanding the literal meaning a little bit. So it's a little bit less textualist, their interpretation. Ironically, the government's position was supported by the Supreme Court under the guise of textualism, because Neil Gorsuch tricked the ACLU lawyer who was defending Moni Priop into saying that her interpretation relied on the idea that this when clause, which is an adverbial clause, modifies the noun alien. And so he got her to say, yes, well, sometimes an adverb can modify a noun, which is not true. And as a result, the Supreme Court decision was against Moni Priyap and against the thousands of immigrants like him. And so they will now have to all be rounded up because an adverb cannot modify a noun.
There's sometimes the feeling that these types of questions and we might call them disagreements or differences of opinion are basically just used in order to evade what many would consider as just or having to answer questions or whatever. You know, one recent thing was when William Barr, the former attorney general under Trump, was questioned by Kamala Harris, who asked him whether anyone suggested to him that he carry out a certain investigation. The details don't really matter. And he actually paused and said, what I'm grappling with is the word suggest. And really huge political questions about, you know, possible impropriety by the Justice Department, all these different things come down to what does he think the word suggests means versus what did Kamala Harris mean the word suggests means at the time, et cetera. These things can these are really not trivial issues when they're applied to such important things, are they?
Right. Yeah. And I think there's this misconception that the textualists are always going to be the ones who are the more conservative judges or decisions. And we're all textualists now, as Justice Kagan says. And in this case that I was just discussing, the text was actually on the side of the people who are on the side of human rights, on the side of people who are getting rounded up and sent to prison unfairly. And as liberals, we shouldn't be afraid of being textualists and of showing that the text really is on our side.
That's interesting. When it comes to the Second Amendment, you know, there's been a lot of confusion about what the phrase well-regulated militia means. There are some who think about it as meaning regulation in the sense of government regulation, the way we think of, you know, OSHA and the Department of Transportation and these types of things. Whereas others say that that's really not what it meant at the time. And you have to understand the language of the time period to really get that. Can you talk a little bit about the change in the English language over time and the role that that plays in us when we try to figure out what is even the textualist interpretation? Because the language has changed over the last 200 years.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that gets into matters of legal theory that are a little bit above my pay grade.
Sure.
I mean, I'm qualified to talk about the principles of semantics and pragmatics that are applicable at any stage of a given language. And whether or not you decide you want to take into consideration the context of the time and apply that to the whatever you think the literal meaning of the words was at that time, that's a matter for you as a legal theorist to decide.
Well, let me phrase it in a different way.
Yeah.
If one is making the claim that we should be going by what was literally meant by those who wrote something, we have to take into consideration how language was used at the time it was written. Do we not? Is that fair?
I think that's a decision that has to be made.
Wow. Some might say, no, we're going to just go by what that would mean today.
It is a bit absurd now that you put it that way, right? So we have to decide, is it the literal meaning of today or the literal meaning of then, of the
yes.
time that it was written? And I think reasonable arguments could potentially be made on both sides. But deciding what the literal meaning is not a trivial thing. It's not something you can just say because you are a native speaker of English. So there's this right. Scalia and Garner tome on legal interpretation that is this big, white, male, authoritative text. And they just state that in sentences of this form, only this type of interpretation is possible with no foundation. And then they appeal to, you know, very serious sounding things like De Morgan's theorem, which is actually a principle of propositional logic and not a principle of natural language. And in propositional logic, everything is disambiguated because you have little brackets. In English, you don't have that kind of disambiguation. And so some of the ambiguity remains. And so you have these people who are very importantly placed people in very big, important positions, making pronouncements with no actual foundation. And the consequences can be enormous.
It was interesting recently watching this Kyle Rittenhouse trial in Wisconsin, where when it got into the jury instruction portion, where the jury was not in the room and it was lawyers for each side kind of talking to the judge about what is going to be the text of the instructions that is given to the jurors, there were lots of interesting moments where the judge said, my belief about what the sort of fundamental nature of this instruction is differs from how it's written. And so I've modified it for the instructions I will be giving the jury based on, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, what he believed more accurately represented the gist of what the jury is to decide. It's interesting that in those situations, it's a couple of lawyers, you know, arguing with a judge, and it's no one is ever brought in who specializes in language to opine as to what is really meant by that. I mean, is that do we see that in any different courts where they say, let's actually talk to someone whose specialty is linguistics to figure out what the intent here is?
Yeah, I would love it if the ACLU would hire a linguist. And I would love it if more people trained in linguistics went into law. And I would love it if more lawyers and judges would talk to linguists about the issues that they're discussing. Because while law is a specialty that you can't just waltz into just because you're a linguist,
yes,
the same is true on the other side. And I wish there was more talking between lawyers and linguists.
Can you give us one or two other kind of interesting examples as to how interpreting text had major consequences that you've studied, and whether they're well-known cases or not? I mean, just anything you think would be kind of interesting and illustrative for the audience.
All right. There is an example that Jill Anderson has written about. It involves the American Disabilities Association, the ADA.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, maybe I should use the Carrico example. So there's a big drug company, Novo Nordisk, and a smaller generic drug company, Carrico.
Mm-hmm.
And Carrico wants to make this generic drug available to a wide variety of people. And the big drug company is preventing that. And there's a law that says that the generic company can make the drug available if the patent does not cover any of the FDA-approved uses. does not cover one of the FDA-approved uses. And that is actually scopally ambiguous. So it is not the case that it covers any of them. So it covers none of them would be one interpretation. Or there is an approved use that it doesn't cover. That's another scope interpretation. So not is a scopally mobile operator. One is a scopally mobile operator. And these two scopally mobile operators interact to create a scope ambiguity, not something that is taught in fifth grade grammar.
Right.
Right. And there's an absurd interpretation where it covers none of the approved uses. And there's a reasonable interpretation where there's one use it doesn't cover. Under that circumstance, the generic company should have the right to make the drug available for that use, right?
Yes.
Just by fiat, the people interpreting this law said, well, whenever you have a negation and something like one, it has to be interpreted like none. That's just what I decided. And therefore, we're going with the absurd interpretation. So the recognition of scope ambiguity was nowhere in the discussions about this law. And as a consequence, people don't have access to affordable drugs.
Right. So the sort of reasonable interpretation would have been this is written in a way where the generic manufacturer really should be able to manufacture this drug on the basis of there being one use. And the one that was applied ultimately was this absurd interpretation that led to the outcome of the generic manufacturer just can't do it.
Exactly.
Right. Wow. Yeah, that the number of instances of things like that probably would be shocking if we were to look in detail at court cases. We've been speaking with Elizabeth Kopic, who's an assistant professor of linguistics at Boston University, who specializes in semantics. I really appreciate your time today and you talking to us about these cases.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
All right, a couple of quick stories I didn't want to miss today. There are people on the right going absolutely crazy because DirecTV, the satellite television provider, has announced that they are going to be dropping OAN, One America News, from their channel lineup at a point in the near future. Now, if you don't remember OAN, you've got Fox News, which is right-wing corporate. You've got Newsmax, which is slightly less corporate and slightly crazier. And then you've got OAN, which is slightly less corporate than Newsmax and even more insane than Newsmax. It is a trash, just pond scum type channel. And DirecTV has announced that they are going to be dropping the channel. DirecTV to drop One America News Network, as reported by NPR. DirecTV will be dropping the channel in a surprise move sure to deal a massive blow to the network that rose to prominence during Trump's presidency. Bloomberg reported that satellite TV provider DirecTV notified the owner of OAN, Herring Networks, Inc., that it would no longer carry the company's two channels when their contract expires. The other channel, A Wealth of Entertainment, dubs itself a lifestyle channel featuring luxury goods. I didn't even know that existed. DirecTV said it made the decision, quote, following a routine internal review. A DirecTV spokesperson told NPR the company looks at many factors in terms of whether to renew. And one question is, does the programming appeal to a broad enough base of customers given increased programming costs and competition for consumers? DirecTV says it's basically a business decision that was not in the best interests of DirecTV. AT&T is a majority owner of DirecTV, and you might remember we covered this when it broke. AT&T has been facing calls to drop OAN over its support of conspiracy theories. DirecTV spokesman declined to comment on whether OAN's editorial policies were a factor. Rand Paul, the Republican senator, he, I guess, had DirecTV. Now, oftentimes people who have DirecTV, I don't want to say sometimes when people have DirecTV or Dish, it's because they live in a rural area without cable. I don't think that applies to Rand Paul, but Rand Paul says he had DirecTV. He says he's canceling it because they are dropping OAN. He says, why give money to people who hate us? I guess supporting the exact type of boycotts that he often advocates against. And then Donald Trump, during his rally in Arizona over the weekend, also alluded to the OAN thing. And he says the channel was threatened by woke executives at AT&T. And he also says boycott AT&T. Take a look at this. Yeah. So, listen, this is all, again, their backwards version of freedom. And it's going to come up in the next segment as well. We talked about it at the top of the show. They say, let businesses do whatever they want. They say these woke boycotts are a bad thing. They say we shouldn't regulate businesses unless. And then all of a sudden, DirecTV makes a business decision, maybe influenced by AT&T also wanting it made as a business decision. And now all of a sudden they go crazy and they say it's suppression of speech and they say all these different things. No one has a right to be on DirecTV. We're on DirecTV. The David Pakman Show airs on a channel called Free Speech TV. And it's on DirecTV and Dish Network. At any time, Free Speech TV could tell us we're not going to carry the show anymore. And DirecTV or Dish could tell Free Speech TV, we're not going to carry the channel anymore. It's not a First Amendment issue. It's completely legal. It's this backwards version of freedom that they seem to only care about when it's convenient for them. And then if it's no longer convenient, it goes out the window. And the next story, quite frankly, is another example of that as well. All right, a couple of quick stories I didn't want to miss today. There are people on the right going absolutely crazy because DirecTV, the satellite television provider, has announced that they are going to be dropping OAN, One America News, from their channel lineup at a point in the near future. Now, if you don't remember OAN, you've got Fox News, which is right-wing corporate. You've got Newsmax, which is slightly less corporate and slightly crazier. And then you've got OAN, which is slightly less corporate than Newsmax and even more insane than Newsmax. It is a trash, just pond scum type channel. And DirecTV has announced that they are going to be dropping the channel. DirecTV to drop One America News Network, as reported by NPR. DirecTV will be dropping the channel in a surprise move sure to deal a massive blow to the network that rose to prominence during Trump's presidency. Bloomberg reported that satellite TV provider DirecTV notified the owner of OAN, Herring Networks, Inc., that it would no longer carry the company's two channels when their contract expires. The other channel, A Wealth of Entertainment, dubs itself a lifestyle channel featuring luxury goods. I didn't even know that existed. DirecTV said it made the decision, quote, following a routine internal review. A DirecTV spokesperson told NPR the company looks at many factors in terms of whether to renew. And one question is, does the programming appeal to a broad enough base of customers given increased programming costs and competition for consumers? DirecTV says it's basically a business decision that was not in the best interests of DirecTV. AT&T is a majority owner of DirecTV, and you might remember we covered this when it broke. AT&T has been facing calls to drop OAN over its support of conspiracy theories. DirecTV spokesman declined to comment on whether OAN's editorial policies were a factor. Rand Paul, the Republican senator, he, I guess, had DirecTV. Now, oftentimes people who have DirecTV, sometimes when people have DirecTV or Dish, it's because they live in a rural area without cable. I don't think that applies to Rand Paul, but Rand Paul says he had DirecTV. He says he's canceling it because they are dropping OAN. He says, why give money to people who hate us? I guess supporting the exact type of boycotts that he often advocates against. And then Donald Trump, during his rally in Arizona over the weekend, also alluded to the OAN thing. And he says the channel was threatened by woke executives at AT&T. And he also says boycott AT&T. Take a look at this.
But you know what? One American News has done a great job. And here's the story. What just happened, the woke executives, I don't know what the hell they're doing. They have so much debt. AT&T is a company that is in serious trouble, and they need AT&T, and AT&T is saying that they may no longer agree to carry this network that's doing very well. You know why? Because people told them not to do it. So maybe what we should do is not use AT&T. You know, if we did what they do to Republican companies, we would have no difficulty. We just don't do it. It seems like not nice, right? But they're not nice.
Yeah. So, listen, this is all, again, their backwards version of freedom. And it's going to come up in the next segment as well. We talked about it at the top of the show. They say let businesses do whatever they want. They say these woke boycotts are a bad thing. They say we shouldn't regulate businesses unless... And then all of a sudden, DirecTV makes a business decision, maybe influenced by AT&T also wanting it made as a business decision. And now all of a sudden, they go crazy and they say it's suppression of speech and they say all these different things. No one has a right to be on DirecTV. We're on DirecTV. The David Pakman Show airs on a channel called Free Speech TV, and it's on DirecTV and Dish Network. At any time, Free Speech TV could tell us we're not going to carry the show anymore. And DirecTV or Dish could tell Free Speech TV, we're not going to carry the channel anymore. It's not a First Amendment issue. It's completely legal. it's this backwards version of freedom that they seem to only care about when it's convenient for them. And then if it's no longer convenient, it goes out the window. And the next story, quite frankly, is another example of that as well. We have a voicemail number. That number is 219-2-DAVID-P. Here's a little xenophobia to kick off the week for us. Take a listen to this.
Not sure if you'll put this on the show, but listen, you people who aren't from this country, just shut the f*** up.
Right.
Okay?
If you are not from the U.S., you have no right to speak. But it only applies to first generation, because just about everybody here was born to someone who was either born elsewhere, or they were born to someone who was born elsewhere. You get the point. But I guess you have to be born here to have opinions.
End of story. Go back to your own f- country and shut your mouth. You don't know what the f- is going on in America, and you
right.
never will understand it.
Yeah. By the way, that's a Rhode Island accent. That's not a Boston accent, just so people know. We get a lot of hate from Rhode Island. There's really quite a xenophobic right-wing enclave in Rhode Island. It's probably would be an interesting thing to study. But this is a very old idea. You know, if you're not there was a point where during the Iraq War, they would say, if you haven't served, you can't have an opinion about whether we should be in Iraq. Really? It doesn't make a lot of sense. It's a really weird thing to say. You know, I've been here since age 5, and I know far more about what's going on here than in any other country. We've got a great bonus show for you today. Sign up at joinpacman.com to get instant
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
CT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
With your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house! Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
Today, a Democracy Now! Special, Dr. Martin Luther King in his own words. We hear excerpts of two historic speeches, Beyond Vietnam and I've Been to the Mountaintop, from the night before he was assassinated in 1968.
We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. Longevity has its place, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will, and He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land.
Dr. Martin Luther King for the Hour, coming up. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today is a federal holiday that honors Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. He was born January 15, 1929. He was assassinated April 4, 1968, at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. He was just 39 years old. While Dr. King is primarily remembered as a civil rights leader, he also championed the cause of the poor, organizing the Poor People's Campaign to address issues of economic justice. And Dr. King was a fierce critic of U.S. foreign policy and the Vietnam War. Beyond Vietnam was the speech he delivered at New York's Riverside Church on April 4, 1967, a year to the day before he was assassinated. In it, Dr. King called the United States the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Life magazine called the speech demagogic slander that sounded like a script for Radio Hanoi. The Washington Post said King, quote, diminished his usefulness to his cause, his country, his people, unquote. Well, today we let you decide. We play an excerpt of Dr. King's speech, Beyond Vietnam.
After 1954, they watched us conspire with Diem to prevent elections which could have surely brought Ho Chi Minh to power over a united Vietnam. And they realized they had been betrayed again. When we ask why they do not leap to negotiate, these things must be remembered. Also, it must be clear that the leaders of Hanoi considered the presence of American troops in support of the Diem regime to have been the initial military breach of the Geneva agreements concerning foreign troops. And they remind us that they did not begin to send troops in large numbers and even supplies into the South until American forces had moved into the tens of thousands. Hanoi remembers how our leaders refused to tell us the truth about the earlier North Vietnamese overtures for peace, how the president claimed that none existed when they had clearly been made. Ho Chi Minh has watched as America has spoken of peace and built up its forces. And now he has surely heard the increasing international rumors of American plans for an invasion of the North. He knows about